Welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Walter Block, having a really interesting conversation about libertarians, about anarcho-capitalists, and everything that is connected to this topic as well. And there's a lot of points that you brought up during the first hour, Walter, that I'd like to ask more about, and we'll just kind of organically let the conversation flow out here a little bit. But one of the issues that arises has to do with, and we talked briefly about it before, security and safety and everything else. This is an issue that usually comes up as a kind of a defense for government and everything else. But in your view, Walter, should we perceive that these are things that actually cannot be attained in full regard? Meaning that, I mean, of course, we can have our, you know, as you said before, we can have our private security and everything else. But basically what I'm trying to get to a little bit, and I know that Murray wrote about this too, but it has to do with human nature, basically, and this idea that all the things that happens to us as we're alive on this planet are things that we cannot be in control of. There's nothing that we can have 100% control of, but still we let these items kind of control us. It's the famous quote in terms of, you know, what do you favor, liberty or you know, security? And you know, if you give up one, you can't have the other, if you know what I'm getting at, Walter.
Oh, yes. Well, certainly with the Snowden release of and Bradley Manning and Julian Assange and all those people, there's been a release of Obama when he was a candidate saying that this is a false dichotomy. You can have both. And now he, as president, he's saying, you know, it's one or the other. I think it was Benjamin Franklin, or was it Thomas Jefferson, one of those guys who said that if you give up liberty to get security, you'll not get security anyway, and you won't deserve it.
That's right.
These are my own words. That's a paraphrase, but I think that that's absolutely true. Look, the reason that the United States is in such danger now is because, as Ron Paul says, they're over here because we were over there. The terrorists are not attacking us in the Boston Marathon or in 9/11, the World Trade Center, because we have miniskirts or we have, rock music or God knows what. Many countries have that. The Scandinavian countries have that. The reason they're attacking us, and they're very, very careful to say why they're attacking us, it's four or five things. The Israeli policy is one. Another is troops in Saudi Arabia, their holy land. A third one is the Iraqi thing. Madeleine Albright was once told that 500,000 Iraqi children were killed in the Iraq war. And is this acceptable? And she said, yes. Well, you know, that could peeve people. That could tick people off. So these are the reasons, as Ron Paul says, they're over here because we were over there. If we would stop being over there and make compensation for the killings that we've done, they would stop terrorizing us. Now, a lot of people say the Muslims, you know, they want to have world conquest and all that. I don't know. I mean, they can't even get rid of one small country right in their midst. How are they going to get rid of all of us by an invasion? No, the only way they can mess with us is by subterfuge and these kind of terrorists blowing up bombs the Boston Marathon and the 9/11 and other activities. So I think if we really wanted security, if Ron Paul were president, what he would do is he would withdraw all the troops and make an apology and hopefully make compensation for all the deaths that we've been doing and all these drones. I mean, how would we in the United States like it if some other country did what the United States is doing? The U.S. has, I think, 1,000 military bases in about 120 or 160 different countries. Well, suppose that Brazil did this, or Indonesia, and they had Indonesians or Brazilians marching down the streets in the U.S. and raping people like they do in Japan. People in the U.S. would be very, very peeved, and if they didn't have the power to stop the Brazilians or the Indonesians, and I'm just picking on them because they're pretty peaceful countries as far as I know, they would go and start bombing them. So I don't think that there's any justification for the U.S. government violating the Fourth Amendment about making unreasonable searches. 100 million Americans?
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
That's one-third of the country.
Yeah.
The whole idea of this spying is if there's probable cause, if there's some evidence or indication, or even profiling, okay, racial profiling, whatever kind of profiling, I'm not totally against that. But to take 100 million Americans, which is one third, and those are the one third we know about, for all I know, they're monitoring everybody.
Probably, yeah, probably. Now,
you know, and in secret, and as far as I'm concerned, Assange and Bradley Manning and Snowden are heroes. Glenn Greenwald, heroes. The guy who did the Pentagon Papers, they're all heroes because they are stopping this criminal gang,
helping it to get out. Now there, I mean, this could also go on and on forever, Walter. There's no stopping on this because, I mean, as you said before, if there was such a thing as you know, a threat from terrorism, this has now at least been, you know, it's been created by the foreign policy of the U.S. Now more than ever, a lot of people in other countries are angry, if you will, at the U.S. But now they're turning the eyes towards domestic terrorism that is going on internally. It feels like an intense paranoia to you know, when we see these PRISM scandals and the NSA scandal kind of unfolding, that, you know, anyone could be the potential terrorist, and this could just go on and on and on ad infinitum, and it wouldn't stop. It would just, it would be so much surveillance and so much wiretapping and everything else, that this is, of course, in violation of people's privacy. And it's worse than that. As I said, they build profiles on people with on social networks, spying on that. It just, where does it end? You know what I mean?
Well, you know, I tell you, I have Defending the Undefendable 2 or 3, I forget which one. I've got a thing on privacy. I'm defending the privacy violator. There is no right to privacy. The privacy is a wealth. It's a positive right. It's like food, clothing, shelter. If you really want privacy, then draw your blinds. If we were really against privacy, we would have to get rid of all private detectives. And in my chapter, I mention all sorts of private detectives like Sherlock Holmes, and I say that these people would be guilty of violation of rights. They're not. So I'm not against privacy violation. I don't think we have a right to privacy. I'm against the government. Anything the government does, whether good or bad, they're a criminal gang, and they should be disbanded. So I'm certainly against what the government is doing, what the NSA is doing. But suppose some private person were to engage in, spying on somebody. I have binoculars, and I look at you when you're taking a bath or something, and if you don't close your blinds, it's tough on you. So I take a sort of an unpopular view on this. I haven't published on it yet, so mm-hmm. I haven't found the why I'm wrong, or I haven't found the alternative. But right now, this is my view, and I think it's compatible with libertarianism as I understand it, that people have no right to privacy. Now, take the case of the – what do you call those people who killed the Queen of not the Queen of England, but the Diana, Princess Di, the photographer type,
the paparazzi.
That's it, paparazzi. I missed that word. Thanks. The paparazzi violate privacy, but here again we come up with a case of government screwing up the works. Notice, where do the paparazzi go? They go on streets and sidewalks. Well, if the streets and sidewalks are privately owned, then the movie stars or the princesses, Princess Di, would only go on those private streets or private roads where the government, where the private owners of the roads and streets and sidewalks said no paparazzi. So there's a much better way of getting of attaining privacy, and the reason that we have problems with privacy again is because of the government, as in the case of private roads and private sidewalks.
I was reading an article by, I think you and Stefan Kinsella wrote it on federalism, and it was an interesting argument going on there in terms of the short run versus the long run. What is, you know, beneficial is from the point of view of the philosophy of a libertarian, of course. But maybe we could just kind of unravel that or explain that a little bit. If you do recall that article that you wrote together with him, this is basically some things that might be beneficial, if you will, in the you know, short run, when it comes to freedom, basically, might not be that in the long run. And there's this interesting kind of dilemma, if you will, in terms of what we should be, what is considered to be beneficial, I guess, in the quest for freedom. Walter, do you recall the article that you wrote?
Yes, I do, and I'll answer it now. But if we could, I'd like to go back to the safety after we discuss this.
Okay, yeah, sure, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah.
The thing on federalism is, suppose the president of the United States says to the city of New York, unless you get rid of rent control, we're going to, I don't know what, not give you subsidies, we're going to increase your tax, or we're going to make life difficult for you in some way or other. Now, from a libertarian point of view, how do we analyze this? Well, on the one hand, the people, some people say, well, this is good because rent control is a violation of landlord rights and it screws up tenants and it creates vacancies and housing shortages and all. So it's good that he's doing that. Other libertarians say, well, yes, we want to get rid of rent control, but we have to have federalism, and federalism means local control. And if the government, the federal government, tells the city what to do, well, then we can't have experiments of different 50 different states or many different cities. My own view is neither. I take an alternative view to these main contestants here, and my view is, whenever the federal government does something that is compatible with libertarianism, we support it. And whenever the government does something that's not compatible with libertarianism, we oppose it. So we just sort of forget about federalism and look, get our libertarian eyeglasses perched on our noses very firmly and forget about whether it's federal, state, or local, and just say, is it compatible with liberty? And I don't see anything wrong with that stance. So when the federal government tells the city that they must do something bad, well, then we oppose it. And when the federal government tells the city they must do something good, well, then we favor it.
Very good. Now you wanted to return to safety a little bit here again.
Yes, I want to return to safety a little bit. One of the things that really, really ticks me off is this idea, and this is sort of a radical idea, that you can't have a market in used body parts. And we're talking about safety, and I'll also talk about the Federal Food and Drug Administration under safety, because there are many dangers to our safety, and not just terrorist attacks, but also medical safety. So what's going on here? What's going on here is in the U.S. you have, I think, 180,000 or is it 18,000? I'm a little weak on statistics. People die because they need a kidney transplant, and they're on a kidney dialysis machine. Now, my understanding of a kidney dialysis machine, it's a very painful thing. Your kidneys don't work. You have to be on a machine. You have to be attached with whatever to your body, and you have to sit there for 6 or 8 hours a day, and it's very, very painful. And if you don't get a kidney transplant, you die. Now, what happened recently in the United States, there was some little girl, 10 years old, who needed a lung. Otherwise, she was going to die, and they put her up ahead on the waiting list. Well, here's where economics comes in. Why do you have a waiting list? Why aren't there enough kidneys or lungs or livers or whatever to give to people who need them? And the reason is the goddamn government has passed a law saying that you can't do it. You can't do it for money. You can only do it for benevolence. Getting back to my socio-biological theories, you can only do it through benevolence. And what they do, what this means is, the only motivation is benevolence, to sign those cards that if you die in a motor vehicle accident, your body parts can go to a recipient. Very few people sign that. So in my introductory economics classes, I say, well, how many sign that card? And that's zero. That is for a zero compensation, and I'll get 10% of them. And I say, well, how many would have signed it if I would have offered you $100 or $1,000 or $10,000 to sign it? And more hands raise. Namely, supply curves slope upward, and the more financial remuneration you give to people, the more supply will come on board. So the people who are responsible for this are really murderers. They are responsible for the deaths of all sorts of people who could have these body parts and don't have these body parts. Another example is the Food and Drug Administration. Now, there was this thing called thalidomide, which was a very good morning sickness pill. Women in the first trimester would cough their guts up, and they were given thalidomide, and this was very good, except that in a few cases you had birth defects. Well, who approved of that? The FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. It's sort of complicated. The West German one, this is before the unification of Germany, approved of it. The U.S. didn't disapprove of it. In any case, the point is, what we're doing with medicine, with drugs and pharmaceutical drugs, not drugs that are addictive that I was talking about before, is we're giving a monopoly to the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. If they make a mistake, do they go broke? look, the reason we have pretty good wristwatches and shoes and ties and paper clips and rubber bands is because if you don't do a good job making rubber bands, you don't make much money and you go broke. And if I do a good job making rubber bands, I can expand my base of operation, which is why ordinary goods that are not heavily controlled are pretty good. But why not apply this to certification for quality of drugs? Wouldn't it be much better if we had a drug certification industry, like a Good Housekeeping Seal of Approval or Consumer Reports or Kosher Food or any of these things? Let them certify drugs and let them not prohibit the use of them. One of the worst possible cases is if you're on your last legs on cancer and you've been given 2 weeks to die, and somebody comes up with a new drug that might or might not cure cancer, and the despicable Food and Drug Administration will not allow you to even try it. It will not allow you to throw the dice and possibly save your life because they have to have their crappy tests. See, the type 1 error is approving of a bad drug like thalidomide for pregnant women. A type 2 error is not approving of anything because they're afraid to approve of something that's later harmful, and then a lot of people die because they can't get the drug. Mm. But the point is, you're going to have these type 1 and type 2 errors no matter what. The point is, that from the Austrian economics perspective, is what you want is a system that automatically penalizes people who make errors and automatically rewards people who do a good job. And that's why you get a better job, not a perfect job. We're human beings. We'll never, perfection is denied us.
That's right.
We're on the wrong side of the Garden of Eden. But they don't allow a market and they kill people. So we're talking about safety. And the third one is doctors. They're now having Medicare, Medicaid, socialized medicine all over the place. In Canada, there was a so-called conservative free market guy who came in power 5 or 8 years ago, but he hasn't even dared touch socialized medicine. Look, the reason we have dire straits with medical care is because doctors are so expensive. Medical care is so expensive on the market, and the reason for that is restricted entry. Namely, the AMA in the U.S., the American Medical Association, restricts entry of doctors. In order to have a medical school, you have to get AMA approval. And they don't approve too much because they want to keep prices of doctors high. And if you have a school, you can't allow any more entrants than they allow you to. So you have many, many more entrants in medical school, rather applicants for medical school than acceptances. Whereas, and as a result, doctors' salaries are 4, 5, 6 times higher than salaries of other people who could have become doctors, say PhDs in biology or chemistry or something like that, who have the brain power and the ability not to worry about blood, say, to have become doctors. So here again, the government is killing people. The government is undermining our safety. If the government would get out of the way and allow free enterprise to come into play and we could have different certification agencies for doctors, then we'd be much better. You know, there was this case where foreign doctors try to get into the United States and they make them take the medical exam in English. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the foreign doctors can't pass the English test, even though they're very competent doctors. Milton Friedman, and here I agree with Milton Friedman, tells the story of the Austrian doctors, nothing to do with Austrian economics, but the Austrian doctors in 1933, 1938, a lot of Austrian intellectuals emigrated out of Austria, especially Jewish ones because of the Hitler-Nazi situation. And the mathematicians, the economists, the physicists all got jobs in the United States in their field. The Jewish doctors couldn't pass the exam. And the same thing happened when the Cuban immigration to the United States to get away from Castro in the 1970s. A lot of the Cuban intellectuals got jobs in academia, but not the doctors. And the reason was, you know, that they had to take the exam in English. Well, you know, the AMA will say, well, you know, you can't have a lack of communication between doctor and patient, but there are unconscious patients, there are translators, there's the possibility that, say, a Korean doctor could treat a Korean patient without right. having to learn English. So this is just a facade, and this is just another way that the government kills people. So when people say, well, if we didn't, thank God for the government, if we didn't have the government, we'd go down the tubes. The very opposite is the case.
Well, this is so true. I mean, one of the things that's being touted in Sweden all the time is that it's quote unquote free healthcare. I mean, first of all, nothing is free. You pay a tremendous amount of money for it, but the bottom line is that the service that is offered is a bad one. Socialized medicine. There are hardly any private hospitals in Sweden, and it's the system is completely swamped with people. It's just getting worse and worse. This is one scenario where my mom had to be in the system, in the medical system in Sweden for a while due to an accident that happened to her, and it's. What people don't understand is the incredible, delay that there is as well. You don't have a personal doctor that you actually talk to whenever you go in again. There's different people, and despite them having a journal on you and everything else, you have to repeat the same issues of what's going on to different doctors. But they don't have any time, and they're always stressed. And it's so horrendous, the system that's there. Yet this is the one that's being advocated by people who are pro a system like Sweden's, where it's quote unquote free healthcare or free schooling and everything else. But there's nothing, there is no alternative, there's nowhere to turn. But if you do actually go to the few other private hospitals and clinics that are there, then of course you not only have to pay for that, but it's still mandatory for you to pay for the fundamental government supplied socialized medicine. So how is that fair in any regard, Walter? It's crazy.
Okay. It's just horrible. I'm more familiar with the Canadian system of socialized medicine, which I think is similar to the Swedish one. Basic supply and demand says that when you keep the price down to zero, demand is greater than supply. And we have a word for demand being greater than supply. It's called shortage or queues or waiting lists. In Canada, if you want a hip replacement, you have to wait a year. If you want an MRI, you have to wait 18 months or whatever it is. There was this case in Canada where a woman and her horse both got kidney stones. And the horse was taken to a vet and fixed in one day. And if the woman didn't take her horse to the vet and fix the kidney stones for the horse in one day, she would have been put in jail for animal cruelty. And yet, to get her own kidney stones fixed, it took her like 18 months.
Well, that's the same thing in Sweden. I remember my cat got better treatment than my mom did, because it was a private hospital. It takes
cats and horses do better than human beings.
It's unbelievable.
There is no social. What we ought to do if I don't want to have the PETA people get on my case, but if we need socialized medicine, let's do it for cats and horses and not human beings. And let's the cats wait online or the horses wait online. Now, again, I wouldn't do that because I don't want to be cruel to animals either. But right now we're cruel to human beings.
Yeah, that's true. It takes 2 days to get an appointment or days to get an appointment. It takes weeks to see a doctor. It takes months to get a decision, and then it takes, as you said, in some cases, years before actually something practical can be done. And a lot of people are actually dying of their ailments before they can get any help. I've seen it. It's horrible.
But this helps the rich, because the rich can go to another country. And when a Swedish rich person goes to Canada, he gets put right in front of the line. And when a Canadian or an American comes to Sweden or whatever, they get put right in front of the line because they're paying a lot of money. So this is very, very cruel, especially to the poor.
Yep.
So you think the progressives, the lefties, the commies, the labor union types would be against socialized medicine, but you'd be wrong. Why? Sociobiology. We're hardwired against free enterprise.
Very interesting. I wanted to ask you a little bit about egalitarianism, the ideas of equality. Murray Rothbard wrote a piece called Egalitarianism as a Revolt Against Nature. In your view, Walter, is egalitarianism a goal that ever can be achieved within humanity? What does this strive come from, do you think?
Well, I think there's good egalitarianism and bad egalitarianism. Good egalitarianism is that the non-aggression principle applies to everyone equally. Namely, you shouldn't rape a rich woman and you shouldn't rape a poor woman. Namely, you shouldn't kill a rich man, you shouldn't kill a poor man.
Right.
You shouldn't kill anyone. You shouldn't rape anyone. You shouldn't steal from anyone. Everyone is equal. Everyone has an equal right not to be aggressed against. So that's the good egalitarianism. What's the bad egalitarianism? Bad egalitarianism is taking money from Bill Gates because he's rich and giving it to you and me because we're not as rich as him, a lot less rich than him. And it's very hypocritical. What I try to do in my analysis of this is to say, well, why just redistribute money? Money isn't really that important. Let's talk about redistributing IQ points. Why don't we take, assuming we had a machine that could transfer IQ points from those with too much of it to too little of it? So you take a guy with a 200 IQ and you take a guy with a 50 IQ and you put them both in the IQ machine and you press the button and now they both come out with an IQ of 125, if my math is correct. Now, is this fair? Should we force people with a lot high IQs into these machines? Would the people who advocate egalitarianism volunteer their kids to take IQ points away from their kids and give it to kids with less IQ? Hardly. Another reductio ad absurdum of this is eyes, E-Y-E. I have two eyes. Most people have two eyes. Some people have zero, namely they're blind. So what we ought to do is go around to people with two eyes, grab one of their eyes, and against their will, not through a market, not through the voluntary system, not by offering them $500,000 for their eye, at which point they might be willing to, that I would certainly favor, but just compulsory taking their eyes away, just like we do with the progressive income tax. This guy Hollande from France is wanting to have, 90% tax
the
or something?
Death tax, you mean?
No. Income tax. And Depardieu, the French...
He flee to Russia.
he went to Russia or Belgium or whatever.
Yeah.
There was a case in Sweden. Bjorn Borg, the tennis player, they had in Sweden, they had a marginal tax rate of 110% during his era.
Oh, yeah.
That means if Bjorn Borg plays another tournament, say, and he makes $1 million, they're going to tax him 1.1 million.
Well, do you know the Swedish author Astrid Lindgren? She wrote the Pippi Longstocking story.
No, I didn't know. Tell me about him.
Well, there's just this one famous case. You know, she's a famous author, and at one point in her life, she had to pay 102% in taxes because of her income of her famous stories that went worldwide. So there's this number of cases where it just goes like. It's hilarious watching this, you know, get out of hand. Unbelievable.
Well, you know, Bjorn Borg went to Monaco. I don't know what happened to your authoress, but if she had any sense, she'd leave Sweden. I mean, imagine making $100 and have to paying $102 on the basis of that.
Yeah, that's right.
You pluck the golden goose.
And she was a staunch social democrat to the day she died, and I never understood why. But, you know, that there you go.
Well, I understand why, because she was hardwired for it.
Oh boy, yeah, it's interesting. Well, so back to the equality aspect here again. If we are equals or not as human beings, and it doesn't mean that we should be, you know, in that sense treated unequal. But you know, you have things in the States like No Child Left Behind and things like that. That there seems to be a tendency to try to normalize, you know, if I can use that word, everyone as opposed to. See the differences, see the talents, and raise those up. This is certainly true in Sweden as well, where we have these unwritten rules and laws. I've talked about it many times before on the program, but it's about bringing down everyone to the same standard as opposed to see the differences and the different talents and encourage these in people. And I think that's a horrible, horrible way to go about it. And I think we're doing ourselves, humanity at large, a tremendous disservice to where we're going to go in the future. What do you think, Walter?
Yes, I agree. There was this author, Kurt Vonnegut, sort of a lefty author, and he had a short story, Welcome to the Monkey House. I forget the name of the short story, but it was a thing where you had a handicapper general, and if you were very strong, you had to carry a 100-pound pack on your back, and if you were very smart, you had to carry earphones that pounded at you so you couldn't think, and if you were very short, you had to have your legs stretched, and if you were very tall, you had to have your legs cut off or something to make people equal. This is, just crazy. Then they have this thing in the U.S. that the black student quality is higher than is lower than the white, and the Oriental is higher than the white, but they never talk much about that. And then they say we've got to equalize this so that, you know, a white kid in the fifth grade doesn't read equally well as a black kid in the ninth grade or something like that. I wonder why they don't have an attempt to equalize jumping or running ability, where black people have much more of it than white people. There was even a book, White Men Can't Jump. Well, it's true. Look at the NBA finals now, the basketball, mostly black people, and they're magnificent athletes. That doesn't seem fair. And, you know, we're the people, you know, I'm short, fat, and Jewish, and we're very underrepresented. We're 1% of the population and 0% of the basketball or football or baseball. That's unfair. These are all sort of reductio ad absurdums. My favorite mentors on this entire issue are two black economists, Walter Williams and Thomas Sowell.
Thomas Sowell, yeah, he's great.
Oh, he's magnificent. Well, he's a bit of a warmonger. Both of them are. So they're not really libertarians, but they're very, very good on this sort of racial prejudice kind of thing.
Yeah.
Walter Williams tells the story of prejudice. I mean, prejudice is prejudging, namely judging from past experience. Namely, this is induction, the scientific method. Walter Williams tells the story of you go into a room and there's a tiger sitting on a couch. What do? Do you shut the door, in which case you're prejudiced and you're stereotyping the poor tiger? Or do you go up to the tiger and ask him if he's a friendly tiger or a nasty tiger? The whole thing is crazy.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting. I wanted to ask you a little bit about Lysander Spooner as well. Yes. Very good, anarchist American. He lived from 1808 to 1887. And some really interesting works there as well. What do you think of Spooner's work?
Oh, I'm a big fan of Spooner, Lysander Spooner. My favorite essay of his is a thing called No Treason, where he says there's no treason not to disobey the Constitution because the Constitution wasn't agreed upon. You see, a lot of people think that the Constitution of the United States was some sort of compact or contract between the people and the government. And, I never signed it. I must have missed the meeting where everybody else signed it because I didn't sign it. And I don't think you signed the Constitution. And now, you see, what they try to say is that the government is sort of like a golf club or a tennis club or a social club. Look, if you join the golf club and you don't pay your dues, well, they kick you out, and rightfully so. But you have to agree to be in the golf club or the tennis club or the chess club or whatever club it is. But the United States is not a club. The Swedish government is not a club. None of these governments are clubs in the sense that in a club you have to agree to join and be bound by the rules. And then people say, well, if you don't like it here, leave. And my answer to them is, well, you leave. You, the government, have no more right to the United States than me, the person, the resident who's living in the United States. So what Spooner does is he goes through all sorts of arguments in favor of the idea that government is really a contractual and therefore legitimate organization. Like he says, well, you pay taxes, don't you? Therefore you agree. And he says, well, you know, you pay money to the highwayman, to the robber. It doesn't mean you agree to be robbed. And then he goes to voting. Well, you voted, therefore you're bound. And the example to that is sort of like, well, suppose you were a slave and the slave owner said you could vote between overseer goody and overseer baddy, and overseer goody would only beat you once a week and overseer baddy would beat you every day, three times a day. And everyone votes for overseer goody so that they get whipped less. Does that mean that they approve of slavery?
No.
Spooner has got all sorts of wonderful little tales like this to illustrate just what the nature of the government is.
Well, indeed, exactly. I really get you to think about these concepts and everything. I guess I was reading a little bit more about this. Your view on this is that let's take the Constitution then, for example, it's a good thing to the point where it helps to limit the United States government. Therefore, it should be, they should stick to it. But ultimately, I see it as an illegitimate institution, government, and therefore, ultimately, down the road, you're not in favor for it. But there are certain things along the way, if you will, that actually helps to limit the centralized power that they have. Correct?
Exactly correct. I mean, they allowed us to vote, and I supported Ron Paul because he was publicizing libertarianism in a magnificent way. So I favor that, and I favor anything that helps reduce the power of the government, the Fourth Amendment, the Second Amendment, the First Amendment, all these Bill of Rights are good things. The whole document is illegitimate in the sense that nobody agreed to it. But if these people, our lords and masters, are willing to allow themselves to be handcuffed a little bit from reducing our freedoms, I see no reason why we shouldn't take advantage of it.
How do you think, Walter, that we could begin to approach a more a society based on more voluntary actions as opposed to forceful as it is right now? I mean, the discussion is so far off, of course, at this stage. It's not a discussion of should we have it or not. It's rather how much of it should we have? And the marginals that is being discussed is like hardly any difference. So in your view, how do you see not only, you know, in America, but around the world, in all countries, people begin to approach a discussion like this? What is it? Education? Is it just sharing these ideas that we've been talking about? What do you see as a you know, move towards a solution to some of these problems?
Well, yes, I see education. But let me put a little perspective on this. When I got into the libertarian movement in 1962 or 3, and when I met Murray Rothbard in 1966, my estimate is that there were maybe 100 libertarians in the whole world. And now I would say there are more than 100 groups, organizations that I've never heard of that are really staunchly libertarian. In the last year or so, I've lectured in Australia, Brazil, Argentina, a while back in Korea, all through Europe, even in Sweden. I think I was once in Sweden, although I forget where I've been, all through Canada. Look, there are... We, you know, the gays, the homosexuals say we are everywhere. Well, we libertarians are everywhere. There are thousands, there are millions of us. The Ron Paul phenomenon is just magnificent. Ron Paul goes to a college or a university and he fills up, a basketball field of a basketball stadium of 17,000 people. And they're yelling and screaming about freedom and liberty and Ludwig von Mises and stuff like that. So I think we're moving along. I think education is the only way. Now, there are various ways of educating. I'm in favor of my own school, Loyola University. I'm in favor of the Mises Institute. There's this thing called the Free State Project. Do you know about that?
No, I haven't heard about that. Tell us about that.
The Swedish people might be interested in this. What happened is somebody got the bright idea is that libertarians can't really have too much political effect because we're spread out all over the U.S. and it's a country of 350 million. So let's go to one state and all gather together and we'll have more political power. And what they did, I think, is they got 10 states, the ones with the least population, because it's silly to move to Illinois or Florida or Texas because, you know, a couple of thousand libertarians won't mean much. So they got 10 states with the least population, I guess Alaska, Nevada, New Hampshire, Wyoming, places like that. And they said as soon as they got 5,000 people agreeing to it, I think I'm right on this, I might be wrong on some of the particulars, then we'll all promise to move when we get 20,000 people. So they had 5,000 people, they had a vote, and I think Wyoming and New Hampshire were the two finalists, and I finally picked New Hampshire because it's right near Boston and you can commute from Nashua, which is in southern New Hampshire, and get jobs there. So a lot of libertarians moved to New Hampshire and are creating libertarian havoc, namely freedom and trying to legalize victimless crimes and vote for good people. And this is one way of promoting liberty. Another way is through the Libertarian Party. The Libertarian Party in the United States has done great work, and hopefully there'll be Libertarian parties in many other countries. See, a lot of the countries in Europe, the Libertarian parties are sort of right-wing in the bad sense.
Well,
of, you know,
exactly. They've been branded as such, but this is propaganda, of course, of the current political and the media environment as well. This is very prominent in Sweden, by the way. The as I said before, the political spectrum is intensely narrow. It's left or more to the left kind of thing. And as soon as you have an opposition to that in any regard, it's immediately just branded as a Nazi organization, and that's it. You know, no more discussion. Yeah, well, but that happens also when you have a media which is government subsidized, like in Sweden. You have no free press. You know, it's absolutely horrible. People don't know this.
Well, thank God for the social media. Thank God. I mean, right now, you and I are having a conversation which will be broadcast over the web and. 20, 30 years ago, the media had pretty much a monopoly over conversation. Nowadays, we have this alternative media. LouRockwell.com gets millions of visitors. This conversation that you and I are now having will be broadcast through the web. So we're doing better than we have in the past. Look, Ron Paul got accused of being anti-black and anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish. Mm-hmm. And I started this group called Jews for Ron Paul, and we were defending him against those charges. I mean, he wanted to stop foreign aid to Israel, but he wanted to stop foreign aid to Israel's enemies too.
Yeah.
So it's hard, and, you know, and his two favorite economists, Rothbard and Mises, were Jews, which is hardly typical anti-Semitism.
Yep.
So there are various ways of doing it, but I think education is the only way. And again, given my biological analysis, it's an upward road because most people are hardwired against it. But we have been making progress since 1962 or 1965, gigantic progress. If we make as much progress between now and then as we do from now and into, I don't know, 30, 40 years into the future, the future for liberty looks bright. But, you know, I don't really like to get involved into the case for pessimism versus the case for optimism.
Mm-hmm.
Because I personally am going to do exactly the same thing, whether the pessimists are right or the optimists are right. I'm going to devote my entire professional life to promoting good economics and libertarian political philosophy, whether the prognostication is good or bad. So it really doesn't matter that way. But to answer your question, yes, I think education, gathering together, having think tanks, trying to get involved in academia. We haven't really discussed academia. Boy, I tell you, that's a sewer.
Can you share a little bit with us about that with us?
Well, in my own case, I gave a speech at some university. It was Loyola University in Maryland. I'm in Loyola University in New Orleans. I gave a speech as to why women earn less money than men. And the main reason was because of housework, that women do a disproportionate amount of housework. And then I also discussed the glass ceiling, why so few women get to the top. And there, my analysis, none of this is really original with me, and most of this sort of accepted among economists, although Neil Ferguson, no, somebody else got in trouble. Hans Hoppe, no, I'm getting my, I made errors there. I think Walter Williams and Thomas Sowell are very active in this sort of a thing. And yeah, the reason is that even though male and female IQs or abilities are about the same on average, the standard deviation or the variance of males is very, very wide, and the standard deviation or variance of women is very narrow. They're clustered toward the mean, women are. And there are good socio-biological reasons for that also, which is a whole other story. But in any case, I gave that analysis, and I said that another very basic element of economics was that wages depend upon productivity. And then someone asked, well, why do blacks have lower wages than whites? And I said, well, it's because of lower productivity. And there are two theories as to why the productivity is lower. One theory is that it's because of this is sort of the politically correct theory. It's a vestige of slavery. It's because of Jim Crow laws. It's because of inner city schools being bad. And then the politically incorrect view is that they have lower IQs. And I gave that speech. And then all hell broke loose. People who hadn't heard the speech started criticizing me and accusing me of, what was it, being against blacks or being against women students or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
In my own school, there was this diversity task force that characterized me as a racist and a sexist without even interviewing me, based on not even hearing the talk, which was not even taped, but just on hearing reports in the newspaper.
Yeah.
So look at what happened to poor Larry Summers. He was the president of Harvard. And he speculated that possibly the reason that there were so few women in physics and math at the higher reaches at MIT or Harvard was because of biology. And he lost his job because of that. So the academia is a left-wing cesspool for the most part.
Oh, yeah.
There are exceptions, like my own school, just the economics department. I don't vouch for the rest of them.
Yeah, how does that work, by the way? I mean, can you – I don't know how that functions, but can you – when you speak about your views on economics, your libertarian views, do you, can you speak on behalf of Loyola University, or how does that work?
Oh, no, I can't speak in behalf of Loyola University. I am a professor at Loyola University, but I can't speak in behalf of them. I mean – The school is consisting, I don't know, 300 professors or so and 5,000 students.
But they're all right with you putting your name on it and the fact that you're a professor there.
Well, they're not all that all right with it because this diversity task force condemned me for being a racist and a sexist and therefore not upholding the views of Loyola, you know, to support our students.
Yeah.
And what I said is, you know, that I've got a lot of female students who I've co-authored articles with and several black students who I've co-authored articles with. And I got them to sign letters saying that this is all ridiculous, but that was pretty much ignored. And this diversity task force never even contacted me. I can't speak for the university. I think if anyone can speak for the university, it's the president of the university. But even he can't speak for all the faculty because the faculty have different views. You know, they keep talking about diversity. We have to have diversity. Namely, we have to have a black leftist. We have to have a homosexual leftist. We have to have a female leftist. And maybe even one white leftist. But, you know, in terms of intellectual diversity, not only my university, but most universities are not very susceptible. I mean, sociology departments and political science departments, they're English departments, they're perhaps even worse than economics departments in terms of being biased towards socialism and leftism.
Well, exactly. I mean, most school teachers are, and definitely most university professors are lefties. And since this have to do with schooling, it's, of course, very detrimental to this to the diversity of politics when it comes to education. I mean, take again, I'll go back to the example of Sweden, where homeschooling has been banned, for example. So the, and all the so-called there are a few private schools, but they really call it free schools in Sweden. But they're still very much bound to the government curriculum. So that doesn't make them any different, really. So again, you know, the diversity that you get in the education is just non-existent. It's horrible.
Yep. Well, we have the book 1984, Brave New World. These were prescient, and that's the way we seem to be moving. Although, as I say, there are good points too. You know, Ron Paul and the libertarian movement all around the world. And on the other hand, the media and academia and politics are horrors, fever swamps.
Indeed, very good. Well, I've really enjoyed this conversation, Walter. I definitely think we could hook up at some point again if you're up for it and talk more about many of these topics, of course, as they come in. We've kind of just brushed the surface a little bit here. But why don't we leave people again with you giving out your website and if there's any particular book that you'd like to recommend for newcomers to your work?
Well, my web is walterblock.com. And my most famous book is Defending the Undefendable, and that would be probably a good introduction to libertarianism. It's available at the Mises Institute, Mises.org. You can get the book there.
WalterBlock.com, Mises.org, and check out LouRockwell.com as well. Thank you so much, Walter. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on your show. I appreciate it too.
That wraps up our program for today. Thanks, guys and gals. We appreciate your interest in listening and learning new things, new perspectives, and a different take on many of the problems that has been handled so badly for so many years with the same suggestions and more of the same. I also just want to say thank you to everyone joining us here in the members area. We also get a lot of positive feedback over email and from folks who appreciate and enjoy what we do, so thanks for that. Before we wrap up, I just want to let you know that we have Allison Adams coming on next, talking about mouth body health, toxic dentistry, and a natural recovery plan. After this, we have Alan Abadesa with Douglas Bowles and William Klaus on the Sync Book Volume 2. Later, we have an update from Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire and Radio 314. We'll have the guys from Joy Camp coming up. All right, thanks, guys. All the best to you and yours. Stay focused, and we'll be back with much more in just a few days. Take care.